Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, we're live at Bryant Park, and we're listening to author David S. Reynolds. He's giving a talk on his book, Mightier Than the Sword.
A new program for us in the Bryant Park Living Room. This is the first lecture series that we've done. The Civil War is an important subject. It informs us in so many ways. But I think we all agree its intrinsic value for us is the history of our the development of the United States as a nation. It's a vast subject. It fascinates us and horrifies us at the same time. And as a historic event, we all know that the Civil War continues to be inspirational. There are numerous books, plays, feature films, television dramas, and documentaries that all are about the Civil War. As far as the content for our programs, it's very fulfilling for us to be associated with two prestigious organizations for this series, the New York Historical Society and Oxford University Press. We want to give our deep thanks to the Historical Society and Oxford University Press for their collaboration on this series. As you know, the New York Historical Society is home to both New York City's oldest museum and one of the nation's most distinguished independent research libraries. It is known for the quality and scholarship of the presentations that explore the rich history of New York and the nation. And our primary contact for this series has been Dale Gregory, the Vice President of Public Program, and his staff, and we have Alex Castle and Justine. I didn't get Justine's last name, I'm sorry. It's okay, but Justine, thank you. And Alex, thank you. They're at the back. And if they have any questions about the Historical Society, they're going to help us out. We're honored to have them as in Bryant Park as a reading room partner. Our association with Oxford University Press has been invaluable. We go back a few years now, and both the quantity and the quality of the contributions to the Bryant Park Reading Room has been just invaluable. OUP, Donors Books, collaborates with us on our World Classics Book Club. They help us with our Real Talks, which is a series of discussions on the movies that are screened in Bryant Park, and they also assist us with our author and poetry program. They're always eager to help us out. When I invited them to do the Civil War series, they responded immediately with enthusiasm. So I want to thank Christian Purdy and his staff. And representing Christian this evening is Tara Kennedy. I think she's somewhere. Tara, where are you? In the back? Anyway, Oxford University Press is represented this evening as well. So a thank you to them. Just a brief description or an overview of the series. The Civil War series is going to happen every Wednesday night for the next 6 Wednesdays at 7 o'clock. The guest lecturers for all 6 programs are well-known scholars and regarded as experts in their respective disciplines, as well as experts on the Civil War. These lectures, we hope, will inform us as well as entertain us. And to explain the series, there's a short bio about each of the lectures, so you can pick one up. I would like to introduce our first lecture, is going to be introduced by Dr. Louise Muir, the President and Chief Executive Officer of the New York Historical Society. Dr. Muir has been the Historical Society's President and CEO since June 2004. Under her guidance, the Historical Society is reinvigorating its commitment to foster greater public understanding of history and its impact on the world of today. To support and encourage historical scholarship and develop education initiatives for young people, students, and adults. And please join me in welcoming Dr. Louise Muir.
Thank you so much, and I want to add my words of welcome to all of you, and thank you for being with us, some of you familiar faces from the New York Historical Society, and thank you for being here. It's really my pleasure to introduce this evening speaker and also to partner with the Bryant Park Corporation and Oxford University Press. I am particularly delighted to welcome David S. Reynolds to the Bryant Park Reading Room. He's Distinguished Professor of English and American Studies at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, one of my former colleagues, great colleagues, and one of the country's leading experts in American history and literature. Tonight, he'll examine 19th century America through the works of two pivotal writers, Harriet Beecher Stowe and Walt Whitman. Professor Reynolds is the author of Mightier Than the Sword, Uncle Tom's Cabin and the Battle for America, which was just released in June to great, great acclaim, and congratulations for all the great press you've received. The book examines the monumental influence of Harriet Beecher Stowe's famous novel. She won the prestigious Bancroft Prize in American History for Walt Whitman's America, a Cultural Biography, which also won the Ambassador Book Award and was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. He's also the author, among many other books, of John Brown, Abolitionist, and the editor of the 150th anniversary edition of Whitman's timeless classic, Leaves of Grass. As always, I always ask, and those of you from the New York Historical Society will be familiar with this, that you please make sure your cell phones are turned off and anything else that might make a noise. And now please join me in welcoming David S. Reynolds.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot, Louise. I really, it's great to be here. If you can't hear me, just raise your hand. I feel I've never given a talk on a stool before. I feel like I should be with my guitar here or something. So you'll bear with me. In a way, it's kind of like coming home for me, because for years I taught at the Grad Center, which was on the 40th floor of the Grace Building across the street, and we used to look down on Bryant Park, and it's just wonderful to be back here. I still teach at the Grad Center, but now it's in the old Altman Building on 34th and 5th. So it's not too far away, but it's great to be in Bryant Park. As was mentioned, 2011 marks the 150th anniversary of the outbreak of the Civil War, which broke out in April 1861. And it's also the 200th anniversary of the birth of Harriet Beecher Stowe. Her massive bestseller, Uncle Tom's Cabin, was published in 1852, 9 years before the Civil War, and created such an uproar with its anti-slavery message that Lincoln reportedly called Stowe the little lady who made this great war. And in 1855, just 3 years after Stowe's novel, came Leaves of Grass by the Brooklyn poet Walt Whitman. If Uncle Tom's Cabin can be called the most influential novel ever written by an American, Whitman's Leaves of Grass qualifies as the most influential poetry volume by an American. In discussing these two landmark works, we realize the importance of cultural history. Cultural history and political history are too often treated separately. For the Civil War era, we read wonderful book after wonderful book on Lincoln, his team revival, the politics, the Civil War battles, the generals, the soldiers. And then on the other side, we read great book after great book on literature, religion, performance, art, other aspects of culture. But when we look at history, we see culture and politics are not separate. They interpenetrate, they feed off each other, and very often it's the cultural outsiders, the outliers, who lead the way, and then politics follow. Sometimes the cultural outliers are forces for destruction. The prime recent example, a tiny cultural religious group called Al-Qaeda that has shaped much of Western politics for a decade. But sometimes the cultural outliers have identifiably positive results. One thinks of Gandhi, Martin Luther King, a number of others. And on the positive side, there have been few cultural forces as powerful over time as Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin and Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. Both Stowe and Whitman were responding powerfully to a nation fractured over slavery and permeated by racism. On the issue of race, neither Stowe nor Whitman totally escaped the racial attitudes of their era, but it's important to recognize that they were far more progressive on this issue than were most people, most white people of their time. After all, 12 American presidents had owned slaves. Thomas Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence, owned many slaves and wrote the blacks were inferior to whites. Even the anti-slavery leader Lincoln declared that there were essential differences between the races that would forever prevent them from living equally in America, which is why Lincoln supported colonization or shipping
American blacks to countries like Liberia, Central America, or elsewhere. He progressively became more progressive in his thought as time passed, but still for a long time he believed that. On an initial stage, black people were presented as ignorant buffoons. In scientific illustrations, blacks were placed below the Caucasian on a descending scale that reached down to the chimpanzee. Black men were seen as oversexed brutes who didn't mind being sold from plantation to plantation because they enjoyed taking on new mates everywhere. Even a liberal anti-slavery minister like Theodore Parker said of slaves, fidelity to the marriage relation blacks do not understand and they do not expect, neither in their native country nor in the state of bondage. Okay. In contrast to this prevailing racism, Harriet Beecher Stowe and Walt Whitman boldly emphasized the humanity of black people. In Uncle Tom's Cabin, Stowe makes marital fidelity between blacks the driving force of the novel's two main plots, the separation of the enslaved Uncle Tom from his wife and their three children when he is sold by his Kentucky master into the Deep South, and secondly, the escape north to Canada by Eliza and George Harris after they learned that their son Harry is to be sold to a slave trader. Stowe shows that black people were capable of deep family feelings. Stowe herself had grown close to African-American servants in her childhood home in Litchfield, Connecticut, and later when she lived in Cincinnati, she moved a number of blacks and became involved in the Underground Railroad when she and some relatives helped a black woman escape to Canada in freedom. When she lost her beloved son, Charlie, he was a year and a half years old, to cholera in 1849, she said at that moment she felt the agony of a slave mother must feel when she was torn apart from a child. And her first inspiration for Uncle Tom's Cabin came when she was at a communion service in a main church, and instead of imagining Christ suffering on the cross, she had a vision of an enslaved black man being whipped to death at the hands of a cruel overseer. She rushed home, she wrote down the scene, which became the episode in which Uncle Tom is lashed to death at the command of the slave owner, Simon Legree. And then the other chapters flowed to her in what she called a series of visions. In all the chapters, Stowe brought out the humanity and domestic feeling among enslaved blacks. Walt Whitman also put great emphasis on the fundamental humanity of black people. In Lisa Grass's Speaker, that loving, all-embracing eye of the poem identifies at one point with a runaway slave, a bold move in that decade of the Fugitive Slave Act and other pro-slavery laws. I am the hounded slave, he writes, and he imagines the dogs at his heels and his flesh torn by briars as he flees to the north. In other passages, he underscores the dignity and the beauty of African Americans, as in his portrait of the magnificent black carriage driver in Song of Myself, or when in I Sing the Body Electric, he reaches out to people of various ethnicities by imagining men and women at auction, and he writes, examine these limbs, black, red, or white, and he indicates that people of all races, all ethnicities, have so much in common, physically and emotionally and passionately. Although Whitman and Stowe were similar in highlighting the humanity of black people, they were quite different in the way they approached the slavery issue. Whitman feared that his nation would be ripped apart by slavery, and so he offered his loving speaker, that eye, that first person, as a force for reconciliation and unity to his divided nation. One of his first notebook scribblings in his characteristic relaxed prose poetry was about slavery. He writes, I am the poet of slaves and of the masters of slaves. I go with the slaves of the earth equally with the masters of slaves. I enter into both so that both will understand me alike. In Lisa Grass, he announces that he is equally at home in the north and in the south, walking on the hills of Vermont or New Hampshire, or down in Texas or on a Carolina plantation. And in one poem, he describes slaves busily at work on their plantation. There are the Negroes at work in good health. Down in Texas, in the cotton field, the Negro cabins, drivers driving mules or oxen before the reef carts, cotton bales piled high on the banks and wharves. In his prose writings of the 1850s, he actually sometimes supported slavery. In one magazine article, he wrote, "The institution of slavery is not at all without its redeeming points." Despite his occasional identification with fugitive slaves in his poems, he actually supported the fugitive slave law, since he thought the recapture of fugitives was condoned in a clause in the American Constitution, and he hated anything that went against the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't actually mention slavery, but it mentions returning fugitives from labor, so by implication it supported slavery. And that's why Walt Whitman opposed abolitionists like William Lloyd Garrison, who burned the Constitution because they considered it a pro-slavery document. Harry Beecher Stowe, in contrast, showed absolutely no sympathy for the institution of slavery whatsoever. Every fiber of her being was passionately opposed to slavery. And as for the Constitution, she believed in what her friend William Henry Seward called the higher law, the law of natural justice and morality, that she believed was above the Constitution, the Fugitive Slave Act, or any other human law. Uncle Tom's Cabin was called in its own day the ultimate higher law document. Virtually every page of the novel is dedicated to undermining the pro-slavery laws of that time. The plot about the enslaved Harris family that runs away to the North with the help of friendly Northerners directly flouts the fugitive slave law, by which it was a crime for Northerners to assist runaways. The other plot, the one about the sale of Uncle Tom to the Deep South, exposed the injustice of laws that supported the so-called internal slave trade, whereby millions of blacks were chained and shipped to faraway plantations as though they were animals to be bought and sold. Because Uncle Tom's Cabin made an unambiguous, crystal-clear point about the injustice of slavery, it's no surprise that it caught the public's interest, inflamed the slavery controversy, and fueled the tensions behind the Civil War. This overwhelming response stood in stark contrast to Walt Whitman's poetry, which, though better known today than Stowe's novel, fell like a lead balloon on the popular audience of its time. Whitman later recalled that of the first 1,000 copies printed of Leaves of Grass, very few copies sold, he had to give most copies of it away. Now on eBay or something, they're worth about $10,000 a piece or something. But Uncle Tom's Cabin, in contrast, was an international sensation. In its first year, it sold 310,000 copies in America, which is three times as much as any previous American novel. It sold 1 million copies in England and was soon translated into 16 languages, a number that has reached over 80 by now. In the day before the mass media or the internet, there were very few popular diversions, and Uncle Tom's Cabin became one of the first forms of popular home entertainment because it was read aloud to entire families, and the families back there then usually had, like 9 children, 10 children, 11 children, had a very large family. It was estimated that there were 10 readers for every purchaser of the novel, since it was so often read aloud. More than that, the novel bred many tie-ins, puzzles, card games, biscuit tins, chinaware, and even in England, one could buy Uncle Tom's shrinkable woolen cot stockings and Uncle Tom's pure unadulterated coffee. In Paris, restaurants offered menu items named after Tom characters. The most influential tie-ins were the plays based on the novel. Far more people actually saw the play Uncle Tom's Cabin than read the novel. Pathos, thrills, music, impressive backdrops, all the crowd-pleasing elements were there, which appeared throughout the North, and every word made converts to the anti-slavery cause. With its exciting plots and engaging characters, the play and the novel stirred interest, melted hearts, and changed people's minds. Uncle Tom's Cabin made countless Americans feel the horrors of slavery on their nerve endings, and many anti-slavery reformers jumped on the Uncle Tom juggernaut. Previously, the anti-slavery movement had actually been divided between small, conflicting groups that were widely unpopular, even in the North. Uncle Tom's Cabin was a force for unity and cohesion among these fragmented anti-slavery groups. The radical abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison wept as he read the novel, which he said is going to be eminently serviceable to the anti-slavery cause. Equally receptive to the novel were groups hostile to Garrison, anti-slavery groups such as evangelical Christians, free soil politicians, and others. And Stowe said, she said, the fact that the wildest and extremist Garrisonian abolitionists have now united with the coldest conservatives to welcome and advance my book is a thing that I never ceased to wonder at. She couldn't believe it. The novel had a key role as well in the political reshuffling that lay behind the rise of Lincoln and the anti-slavery Republican Party. Back then, the Democratic Party was pro-slavery. The Republican Party was anti-slavery. As Uncle Tom's Cabin stature grew, it gave strong force to anti-slavery politics. It was mentioned in the House of Representatives many times, such as by Representative Joshua Giddings, who declared, a lady with her pen has done more for the cause of freedom during the last year than any savant statesman or politician of our land. The inimitable work Uncle Tom's Cabin is now carrying truth to the minds of millions who up to this time have been deaf to the cries of the downtrodden. Harriet Beecher Stowe was lionized. She continued to spread the anti-slavery gospel. She had a triumphant tour of the British Isles where she was feted and cheered. Although she didn't speak publicly back then, women, unless you were a radical, you weren't supposed to speak. But she sat there, and her husband spoke for her, and she smiled at everybody, and they clapped. After that, she toured the continent. Same situation there. When she returned to America, she continued her anti-slavery activity. She organized some anti-slavery rallies behind the scenes and sent around petitions by women, signed by women against pro-slavery laws like the Kansas-Nebraska Act. But she soon realized that neither politics nor persuasion were going to rid the nation of slavery. To the contrary, slavery was becoming ever more deeply entrenched in the South, partly because of the cotton economy, but also, ironically, partly because of Uncle Tom's Cabin. Stowe's novel was so popular that the South considered it uniquely dangerous. Most Southern states criminalized the sale of the novel. One black man who was found with the novel just in his home, lying around, was sent to prison for 10 years. A huge new body of pro-slavery literature arose in the South, defending slavery in direct response Uncle Tom's Cabin. 30 novels written by Southerners directly tried to refute Stowe's novel. In these so-called anti-Tom novels, slavery was presented as a wonderful institution sanctioned by the Bible that brought savage barbarians from Africa and provided them with shelter, food, and religious instruction. Harriet Beecher Stowe and Walt Whitman have both shown sympathy to enslaved blacks, but neither have been able to do away with slavery. So is immensely popular, but had, if anything, made the divide between the North and the South even deeper than it had been before. Whitman looked like he repaired this divide by investing the South, and he virtually ignored by the nation that he hoped to feel in his poetry. I'm just saying that both writers felt a sense of frustration. Whitman hammered away the theme of togetherness and national unity, which became even more pronounced in the second and third editions of Leave the Grass, published in 1856 and 1860, respectively. So, meanwhile, came to realize that slavery was so deeply rooted in Southern ideology that violence alone would be needed to eradicate it. For this reason, the next anti-slavery novel, Dread, was far gloomier than Uncle Tom's Cabin. In Dread, she pictured American slaves who hide out in Southern swamps and plots vengeance against white slave owners. Although the slave Dred dies before he can carry out a revolution, the novel clearly shows that Stowe's mind had taken the darker turn than when she had written Uncle Tom's Cabin in 1852. This is why she came to revere the anti-slavery warrior John Brown. He can feel both ways that were in Kansas, inland, Metaphor, and Puppetry, Virginia, after which he was taken and then home.
Those who view Brown simply from that of Whitman, who saw Brown as the greatest of foolhardy men, whose violent actions threatened to lift the Nixie Party even more. Brown's attitude is actually closer to that of two former pacifists, Henry David Thoreau and Waldo Emerson, who, believing now only bloodshed would end slavery,
swayed Northern Italy by comparing Brown to the leaders of the American Revolution and even to a kind of militant Jesus Christ figure, kind of martyr figure. Stella called Brown a brave good man who has done more than any other man for the honor of the American name. One observer of the time declared that Stowe had spread anti-slavery kindling far and wide, and John Brown had lit it with the torch of violence. He had some substance to his claim. Certainly no other cultural figures polarized the nation to the degree that Stowe and Brown did. And it might be argued that no other cultural figure helped unify the nation eventually to the degree that Walt Whitman did. Whitman witnessed the Civil War firsthand. His brother George fought in many of the major battles of the war, and Whitman himself served selflessly as a volunteer nurse in the Civil War hospitals, where he visited more than 100,000 soldiers over the course of 4 years. Whitman saw the Civil War as a welcome thunderstorm to clear social and political atmosphere and aroused a new dedication of principle from average Americans. Although Whitman, of course, supported the North in the Civil War, he also admired the spirit that the Southern troops displayed, and if the war, he felt, saved America, it can be said to save Walt Whitman himself. Formerly neglected in Hillary, he came to be truly admired because of his work as a hospital nurse, and soon after the war, he was enshrined as the good gray poet. Also admired were his powerful writings about the war. He once said that the real war would never get into the book, but we get such vivid glimpses of the war, both in his poetry volume, Drum Taps, and his notebook jottings that were eventually published as memoranda during the war. And Whitman contributed greatly to the mythologizing of Lincoln through his great poetic eulogies, When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloom, and Oh, Captain, My Captain. The national unity Whitman had long dreamed of was achieved in Lincoln after being murdered in Ford's Theater in April 1865, became a national hero. He was since been treasured by both Northerners and Southerners alike. Whitman helped generate this nationwide reverence for the martyred Lincoln, particularly in his poem, Oh, Captain, My Captain, which became by far his most popular poem, endlessly recited and memorized. And once Whitman earned respect as the poet of Lincoln in the war, many people started seeing value in his marvelous earlier poetry, which had once been dismissed. So by the time of his death in 1892, Walt Whitman was widely viewed as America's greatest poet, and he'd become as much a celebrity as Harriet Beecher Stowe. Harriet Beecher Stowe's support in the Civil War was as passionate as Walt Whitman. She, too, had a personal connection with the war because her son, Fred, served in the Union Army, was wounded at Gettysburg. She contributed to the Lincoln mythologizing by writing a very thoughtful magazine piece on him that was reprinted in her book, Men of Our Time. Meanwhile, Uncle Tom's cabin took on a new life. It went through many editions after the Civil War, and by 1905 was reported to be the second edition of the Bible, among the most popular books in America. And it was still even more popular as a play than as a novel. It was the longest running and most popular play in American history. Right through the late 19th century and into the 20th century, dozens of acting companies fanned out across America. Did anybody see the play that was put on here in the Village? By Alex Rowe. It was very well done. A minimalist interpretation. Very simple than much simpler than the overdone interpretations back then. Anyway, dozens of acting companies fanned out across America, performing the play in every hamlet, town, and city. The play was also popular throughout Europe and appeared as far away as China, Russia, India, Australia. Many versions of the play, however, changed Stowe's hero, Uncle Tom, into a passive, obsequious old man. He now was actually in his 40s. He had three kids. He's muscular and strong. But in the plays, he became this kind of weakling, this older weakling, particularly during the Jim Crow era, which liked to present African Americans in its way on its stage anyway. And this is where the term Uncle Tom arose, as we know it today, as a weak-kneed person who kowtows to whites and who sells out people in his own race. Still, in all its versions, nevertheless, the play didn't totally abandon the central point about the cruelty of slavery. And for this reason, the Uncle Tom plays were hated in the South and were often banned there. When the Virginia author Thomas Dixon saw an Uncle Tom play in 1901, he was so outraged that he launched an all-out war against the novel, which he considered a hateful work that had brought about a terrible racial reversal in America by helping to liberate millions of British blacks who, after the Civil War, supposedly preyed on white women. Dixon wrote bitterly that Uncle Tom's Cabin, quote, caused the Civil War, killed the men, desolated and ruined the South, and changed the history of the world. He responded to Uncle Tom's Cabin by writing virulently racist novels that adopted the names of certain characters and pointed them in an opposite direction by advocating the punitive lynching of blacks. One of his bestsellers, The Klansman of 1903, was the basis of B.W. Griffith's adeptly made yet a point film of 1915, The Birth of a Nation, which made heroes of the Ku Klux Klan. The movie became not only the most popular film in the silent era, but also prompted the real-life resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan. In the 1930s, became the most popular movie of all time, Gone with the Wind, the romantic epic of the Old South, based on a novel by the Atlanta author Margaret Mitchell, who said she wrote the novel in part to counteract what she saw as the anti-Southern message of Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. Even as these pro-Southern films were supporting Jim Crow, Uncle Tom's Cabin was taking its own mark on the film industry. No less than 9 silent films based on Stowe's novel appeared between 1929 and 1927. And in the best of these films, the lead character, Uncle Tom, is portrayed as a dignified and sympathetic and young and muscular figure, the way he is in Stowe's novel. And so there was a massive Hollywood duel going on between pro-Tom and anti-Tom films. A third duel was playing with him among American historians. One group, the so-called Dunning Group, named after Columbia Professor William Archibald Dunning, said that the Civil War, caused by fanatics like Harriet Beecher Stowe and John Brown, resulted in Reconstruction, which they called a tragic time when newly emancipated blacks awarded a social position they didn't deserve, proved to be incompetent leaders, and worse, a constant threat to white women because of their uncontrollable lust. But there was another group of historians led by W.E.B. Du Bois, they had a very different view of the American past. According to this view, the Civil War was emphatically a change for the better, since it resulted in the emancipation and political empowerment for blacks, at least for some blacks. From this vantage point, both Stowe and Brown seemed like heroes. Du Bois wrote a laudatory biography of John Brown instead of Stowe, thus to a frail, overburdened Yankee woman with a steadfast moral purpose. We Americans, black and white, owe gratitude for the freedom and liberty that exists in the United States of America today. And this positive view of the Civil War Reconstruction is now widely accepted, and it's a good time for us to recognize the importance of Stowe and her novel. After all, during the Civil Rights era, it was both those who most closely resembled Uncle Tom, Stowe's Tom, not the sheepish one, a popular legend and popular myth, the one on the stage play, the real Uncle Tom. The ones that closely resembled him proved most effective in promoting progress. Rosa Parks didn't mind the Uncle Tom label, and she believed a great change could result from nonviolent moral protest. Martin Luther King was often called Uncle Tom, but he stuck to the principle of nonviolence. When Martin Luther King took an assassin's bullet while standing on a hotel balcony in Memphis in 1968, Uncle Tom died again, and again he had opened the way to freedom. It's time that we do justice to Harriet Beecher Stowe by correcting our understanding of Uncle Tom and Stowe's other great characters by recognizing just how crucial they had been to America and the world history. I try to do so in my new book, Mightier Than the Sword, Uncle Tom's Cabin in the Battle for America. That and a few other my book for the sale in the back. And for sale on Tommy. And since I think it's important for readers to go to the original source, another book out there is a new edition I just did of Uncle Tom's Cabin called the Standard Edition with over 100 original beautiful illustrations completely free of stereotypes like caricatures, and they really capture the essence of that novel. What I especially like about Uncle Tom's Cabin, besides its terrific story and its moving characters, is its positive outlook. Walt Whitman once said that he stood for the cheerful inclusion, and he wrote cheers. Cheer, is there anything better than any religion, any art? Simple cheer, just cheer. The same could be said of Harriet Beecher Stowe. It puts tolerance and compassion at the heart of her novel. She made sure to avoid demonizing all slave holders. To be sure, there are villains in the novel, particularly the cruel Simon Legree, the heartless Marie Sinclair, both of them slaveholders, but a number of other Southern characters are kind, loving people. It's not the South or Southerners Stowe wants to attack. It's the institution of slavery, which, in her view, can poison human relations and can lead certain people to display ugly qualities. She ardently hoped slavery would end if people would just need to feel right. As you know, tragically, that did not happen in the case of slavery. It took 4 years of bloody civil war to uproot slavery. But I remain an optimistic humanist, and as I argue in Mightier Than the Sword, those novels still offer important lessons to us today about tolerance, decency, and the real meaning of democracy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I did want to mention that we're going to open this up to Q&A right now, but the books are for sale at the back table. So if you want to get your book signed by David Reynolds, please do so, and we'll form a line, and he'll just sign them right up here. But we're going to open it up for some questions.
Harry Beecher Stowe, William Lloyd Garrison, Henry Ward Beecher, all of those people, while they were intentionally opposed to slavery, didn't consider black people the equal of white people, and they all walked away from black people as soon as slavery ended. Would you comment on that? I mean, the racism that pervaded this country, pervaded the North and South.
Yeah. Well, it's all relative. Harriet Beecher Stowe had a kind of romantic racialism that she borrowed from the man in Alexander Simnot, whereby blacks were supposedly more gentle and more Christian and more pious and actually more family-oriented for whites. For her, that was a good thing. William Lloyd Garrison was not free of racism. Certainly, Lincoln was not free of racism. You can count on one hand that John Brown, Lydia Maria Child, to some degree Wendell Phillips, I can count on one hand the white people that I know from that era that really didn't show some signs of racism. But when you compare them to so many other people that I could tell you about, they look progressive, which is why the South really thought that she... There's a suddenly political cartoon showing Harriet Beecher Stowe in hell holding a book called Uncle Tom's Cabin. I love the blacks, and for the South, that was such a horrible thing. So for the South, she was absolutely, in love with black people and everything. So it was totally all relative. But yeah, you can go back and you can find passages in Uncle Tom's Cabin, many passages in Lincoln, many passages in Jefferson. Well, Jefferson was a slaveholder, and it's very sad. Whereas if you look in John Brown, Lydia, I'm talking about white people now. Lydia Maria Child, Wendell Phillips. There are just a few others that it's very hard to find passages like that. So it becomes really all relative.
Mr. Reynolds, may I ask you quick questions? Do you know whether Walt Whitman ever visited the Deep South and saw a cotton plantation?
Well, he was down in New Orleans for... he was editor of the New York Picayune, so he witnessed slavery down there and on the trip down there, absolutely, yeah. And he saw, almost surely saw slave auctions, and he witnessed slavery firsthand. And Harriet Beecher Stowe only witnessed it once firsthand when she went across, she was living in Ohio and went across the Ohio River to Kentucky and visited a plantation and sat there. And these scenes that she saw were absorbed into her mind, and many of these scenes later came out in her novel.
Do you know whether John Brown wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin?
Yeah, he did, and he gave a copy to his daughter, although ultimately he dismissed Uncle Tom's staff as being too limousine liberal. And she, in a way, dismissed it herself when she embraced John Brown for the 7 years later, because she turned away from nonviolence and she embraced John Brown. So in a sense, she left behind Uncle Tom's Cabin to some degree, but still Uncle Tom's Cabin set the stage in a way for John Brown. Yeah.
Well, it was very interesting to hear how Tom himself was portrayed long after Stowe wrote the novel, and how the Dunningites believed it in a subservient way. And what I was interested in is that, of course, people are always revising history. So when we get to the Civil Rights Movement, and it's interesting to me that that there were many African Americans who sort of fell for, if I can use that term, this altered view of Tom. Was there any effort at that time to say, well, you know, let's read the novel and see how he was really portrayed? Or maybe it would have been inopportune politically. And secondly, and maybe not as importantly, I was curious, you said that a lot of the evangelical groups, certain groups opposed him, but they were abolitionists as well, right? What was the difference that they had?
The first question about the civil rights movement, actually the phrase Uncle Tom became, among many African Americans, more feared than the N-word. It was just such a negative terminology. However, there were certain people both leading up to the Civil Rights Movement and within the Civil Rights Movement. Rosa Parks actually defended Uncle Tom, and a few people actually, there's a book actually comparing Martin Luther King to Uncle Tom by a guy that said, now wait a minute, the real Uncle Tom was really more like Martin Luther King. He wasn't like the Uncle Tom in the stage play. So there were certain people, and then Alex Haley, who wrote the Uncle Tom's Cabin in a sense for the modern generation or for the 70s and 80s generation, actually wrote an article for the New York Times Magazine saying, now wait a minute, Uncle Tom is not that way whatsoever. And in Roots, in a way, he updates Uncle Tom's Cabin by integrating both the radical forces of the 60s with the less radical forces, and kind of conjoins them in this Kim Tuck-Sin Fay figure. And he uses a lot of the same devices that Harry Beecher Stowe did in Uncle Tom's Cabin. In my book, I compare the two. As for Garrison and the evangelicals, Garrison was part of a group known as Come Outers. They came out from the churches because they thought the churches were too silent on slavery. The churches compromise on slavery, and so they came out from the church, and that's why the Tappan brothers, Lewis and Arthur Tappan, were evangelical Christians, and Charles Grandison Finney, who was an evangelical Christian. They didn't totally accept the Garrisonians, nor were the Garrisonians totally accepted by them. And then there was there were still other divisions between the various anti-slavery groups. Was a political group that, in a way, rejected both the Garrisonians and the evangelicals. And there were the transcendentalists who rejected them all. So, yeah.
Hi. I had a question about the Fugitive Slave Law, the original Fugitive Slave Act of 1792. I'm short, but it doesn't matter. The original Fugitive Slave Law of 1792, which protected the warrant, required that any slaveholder had to get a warrant. So I feel that Constitution and that original slave act was really in the slave's benefit, because the way most people think that the upset versus 1850 really was about a compromise to get California into the Union, and versus in exchange for this Fugitive Slave Act, which allowed them to capture and deputize anybody. So that was one point. The second was, Ms. Tappan brothers, could you talk about how they were instrumental in the Amistad rebellion? That's it.
Okay. Was your second question about Harry Bigelow's attitude for the Amistad Rebellion?
No, you just mentioned the Kassan brothers.
Yeah.
And I know they were involved with the Amistad.
Oh, right. That's right. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, well, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793 was a milder law, but it was partly an inspiration behind Uncle Tom's Cabin. I tell an episode in my book of fugitive slaves in Ohio that were recaptured under the 1793 law, and the people that defended that case all the way to the Supreme Court defended the Northerners who helped the 9 fugitive slaves. He eventually was, that fugitive slave law was supported by the Supreme Court, but William Henry Seward, who was a good friend of Harriet Beecher Stowe, said to the Supreme Court that in this case, the Constitution and the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793 are just unjust. And he went on and on in a wonderfully democratic way, impugning the Fugitive Slave Law and the Constitution. And the man that he defended, who his name was John Van Zandt, he became the model for John Van Trump in Uncle Tom's Cabin. So that case became a real inspiration, as I trace in my book, behind Uncle Tom's Cabin. So even though that was a milder law than the 1850 law, it still was one of the inspirations behind Uncle Tom's Cabin.
The Amistad.
About the Amistad.
Oh, the Amistad? I guess the question was, were the Kassans involved in the Amistad? Yeah, they were, and it was mainly John Quincy Adams, right, who is directly involved. But, yeah, as I recall, the Kassans were involved. They were very strongly anti-slavery, and as was John Quincy Adams. That was a very, very inspiring case in which the blacks revolted on a ship were eventually taken to court, but then ultimately, freed. So, are there any questions about Uncle Tom's Cabin or Harry Beecher Stowe? Oh, there's one right back there. We'll have to wait for the microphone.
Some of the results from the John Brown raid was that some Northerners wanted to pay the South for the slaves to make them not property. And John Brown wanted the blacks to rise up and rebel, to have an armed conflict. Can you discuss both of them? What was Harry Beecher Stowe's opinion of both of these things, of basically paying the South for the freedom of the slaves?
Well, her own brother, Henry Ward Beecher, had so-called auctioned off two slave girls in his church in 1848. But the idea of compensated emancipation was very much in the Beecher family. And Harry Beecher so took these formerly enslaved women into their own home and helped to educate them, sent them to Oberlin College. So she believed in the principle that, and even Lincoln brought that up too as a possibility. But after John Brown, didn't want any of that. And after 1859, it became fairly clear. By that time, there were 4 million enslaved blacks in America. Economically, it would be very, very difficult to pull off a massive purchase of slaves in order to emancipate them. And there's no indication that Harriet Beecher Stowe, at that point, even though earlier her brother, 12 years earlier, her brother had purchased two slaves in Brooklyn, had purchased his slaves. There's no indication that she had any faith in that whatsoever by the eve of the Civil War. And what was your second question?
Did she believe the blacks should rebel and rise up against their masters like John Brown wanted?
In Dread, her 1856 novel, she has a slave character who dreams of a violent judgment day against white people. And this slave character is the putative son of Denmark Vesey, who in real life had actually been a slave rebel. So her mind was thinking about slave rebellion. But other than that, there's no indication that she supported violence until she came out on behalf of John Brown and his idea of prompting slave insurrection. At that time, she did seem to endorse the idea in 1859. Yeah. Yes.
I guess.
We only have one. Right here. What was the theater scene like with the production of the play? Was it centered in New York as it is now? Were there large theaters? Was it professional? Were there little country theaters? You know, how widespread were there? Were there little summer playhouses in Vermont?
No. Uncle Tom's Cabin, she didn't want it to become a play. She was from a Christian family, and Christians weren't supposed to enjoy plays or theaters or anything like that. Somebody approached her about writing a play. She didn't want anything to do with it. But then somebody else made a play of it. She never made a dime in many of the plays, and the play became the most popular play in history. But New York, and then it came to New York, and the theater district, of course, back then was way back lower Manhattan, way down lower Manhattan. And previously, theaters had been sort of a bad place. Prostitutes went there and so forth. But Uncle Tom's Cabin was the first play that allowed clergymen to go to plays and ladies to go to plays unescorted. I mean, if they were unescorted, they weren't necessarily prostitutes. They could be just ladies who went to a play. Because there was enough religion and Christianity. And it was the first matinee, because it was so popular that they had to have matinee. And it was the first Saturday evening performance, because on the eve of the Sabbath, but it was religious enough that it became the first play allowed on a Saturday evening. So it really broke theater history in a lot of ways. And there were a lot of these theaters around the country. And then when it was played, however, you asked about, quite often it was played in tiny hamlets and villages, in barns, or in open fields, or in the town hall, just anywhere that could be appropriated as a theater. So I would say more often than not, when you think of all the little hamlets, it was probably played in very primitive conditions, very primitive. Yeah.
Thank you. I wanted to ask about the relationship between the Quakers and Stowe and Garrison and that whole evangelical movement.
Well, the Quakers were an anti-slavery group in general. And in Uncle Tom's Cabin, when the enslaved black couple, George and Eliza Harris, flee with their little baby boy across the ice, they're helped by Quaker people. Harry Beecher Stowe had a very, very deep feeling about Quakers, because many Quakers back then were abolitionists. And so a lot of the good people in that novel are Quakers. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Well, Quakers were pioneers. They were even a little bit different than the Garrisonians. I mean, I described all the different, some of the differences, but I didn't describe all the differences of anti-slavery people. But the Quakers were pioneers. Absolutely, yeah.
Hi, I'm just curious about the sentiment of Harriet Beecher Stowe and many other religious people at that particular time. What was the mood for us when the Pilgrims came to America and the colonies? Are these people that were advocates, or not advocates, but against slavery? Were they an extension of a movement that came from the Protestants that landed here in America first and then the colonies that came later? Is what we see out of slavery, that extension of that particular battle? Is it any damn mutation that's important?
No, well, the people that settled America, what a lot of people forget is that slavery existed in the North as well as in the South. And 12 of the 13 American colonies just before the American Revolution actually had slavery in 12 of the original states. And so slavery wasn't even banished in New York didn't disappear until 1828. And in New Jersey, it was quite a bit later than that that slavery completely disappeared. So you have to realize that slavery was tolerated. No, it was not as widespread in the North as it was in the South, but it wasn't considered totally inconsistent with Northern ideology until really, there were Quakers, there were a few others, there were strands of anti-slavery thought, but that's why it took some galvanizing force such as John Brown's raid, and eventually such as Abraham Lincoln, to really arouse the conscience of the North in a big, big way, enough to fight for it and to bleed over it and to lose one's life over fighting against slavery. Yeah.
Can you wait for the microphone?
Starting the adaptations on the stage and the 9 silent films, film versions of Uncle Tom's Cabin, were the actors generally in blackface who played Uncle Tom, or were there black actors as well?
Well, back then, black people in general were portrayed in blackface. However, in 1878, an African-American took the lead role as Uncle Tom, and that was the first time that an African-American ever took a lead role in an American play. And in 1914, an African-American assumed the lead role in a silent film, and that was the first time that that had happened as well. And after that first 1878 appearance, a lot of African-Americans took the stage in Uncle Tom's Cabin plays. Many African-American entertainers, banjo players, these were big spectacles with a lot of music and a lot of dancing, a lot of fun, as well as a lot of tragedy and a lot of horror, but also there was a lot of adventure and a lot of religion and everything. So in a way, the plays, even though they sometimes demean Uncle Tom as a character, also became an avenue for creativity and African-American performance.
Hi. Was the extent of racist feelings in America as strong, say, in 1800 as it was in 1850? Because I think you have Mariah Edgeworth having a novel with an interracial married couple being read in the United States, and she engages in a correspondence with a young woman in North Carolina.
Right.
It's hard to imagine that happening on the eve of the Civil War.
Well, I think that ironically, you would think as time passed that racism would get less and less, but in the 19th century, pseudosciences like phrenology, ethnography, these pseudosciences arose and actually gave, quote, proof, scientific proof, of racial inferiority and racial difference. So in a way, racism sort of intensified and became actually more of a force. And unfortunately, Walt Whitman, very, very late in his life, accepted some of this ethnographic theory, which went along with eugenics and the disappearance of the so-called inferior races and all of that. So I didn't mention that in my talk, but sadly enough, that in some sense, racism gets stronger as time passes, at least on some level. Yeah.
going to be the last question because we want to have him have time to sign some books as well. So,
wasn't part of that an economic thing? Because cotton became a profitable crop, and therefore it became very valuable to have slavery in the South.
Quite often, as we know, even today, economics can determine cultural attitudes and can control morality as well. And it was true back then, yeah. When cotton became king, and it slowly did become king in the South, a lot of this ideology, this pro-slavery ideology, arose in support of it. Yeah, absolutely, totally. Exactly, yeah. So, these black people can stand the heat and let's just chain them up and send them out there and let them do the dirty work. And so what they're really interested in was cotton and money and keeping this southern economy alive. And so the pro-slavery ideology kind of grows, almost like the cotton itself around that. Yeah. Okay, I want to thank Dr. Reynolds. The wonderful